Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, please join the Patreon campaign. This week, I'm talking to Chris Carter about his book, The Case for the Afterlife: Evidence of Life After Death. Chris Carter is an Oxford-trained philosopher and the author of four highly acclaimed books, as well as several scholarly articles. Hi, Chris. Thanks a lot for coming on my podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called The Case for the Afterlife: Evidence of Life After Death. Could you first of all tell us about the experience you had at college that kind of opened your eyes to all this stuff?
Well, it was nothing terribly dramatic. I was just studying in England and for 2 years. And at the end of the first year, one of my friends was trying to convince me to join him and two other graduate students to spend our next year living in a farmhouse just outside of town. It was owned by our college. I wasn't sure if I wanted to. As an expatriate student, I'd rather be closer to town and college. But then he said something that caught my interest. He said, "The place has a ghost." And, you know, I was a little bit shocked. And I said, "Has anyone seen anything?" And he said, "No, but there's been a lot of strange sounds reported." So I decided to go and see the place myself. It was a two-story stone medieval farmhouse, quite large. And while I was there, I stopped in to speak with the college carpenter. And after a brief chat, I came straight out with it. I just said, "I hear the place is haunted." And he said, "Well, I don't know myself, but the carpenter before me, he swore the place was haunted." Well, that was enough for me, and I moved in. And to make a long story short, I did indeed see and hear some things I couldn't readily explain. Nothing terribly dramatic, nothing that convinced me one way or the other, but it did spark my interest. And after I graduated, I began to reflect on my strange experiences in the old farmhouse. And so I took a trip to the local library and decided to see if there's any solid research had been done over the years on matters such as apparitions and hauntings and perhaps communication with the deceased or the departed. Much to my surprise, I found an awful lot, a lot more than I thought I would. Particularly impressive was the research by the British and American Societies for Psychical Research. I mean, these were both founded in the 1880s. They both included some of the most elite scientists, philosophers, lawyers, physicians, scholars, and clergymen on both sides of the Atlantic who were heavily involved in this research. Most of it was extremely high quality, very rigorous. They found, and despite the often repeated lie that, well, they found nothing, the truth of the matter is they found enough to convince almost every single leading member of the British Society and American Society of the reality of survival by the early years of the 20th century. The only person who remained on the fence, as far as I know, was William James, the philosopher at Harvard. He was the first president of the American Society for Psychical Research when it was founded in 1884. The British Society had been founded 2 years earlier in 1882 by, well, the first president was Henry Sidgwick, a philosopher at Cambridge. Anyway, it's believed that William James sat on the fence, remained very non-committal all his life, because he was in addition to being a philosopher, the president of the ASPR, and he also founded the new fledgling field of psychology, and it's believed that he didn't come out with any sort of commitment on the subject because he didn't want to somehow tarnish the reputation of his fledgling field of psychology. But many of the others, including those who started off as diehard skeptics, such as J.C. Pittington, lawyer Richard Hodgson, both of them were directly involved in research with various mediums, non-professional, I might add. They didn't do it for money. And even they were convinced, and they admitted it. They said, you know, "I went into this with an attempt to debunk mediumship, and I've completely changed my mind. I now find that I was wrong." So, as I said before, I do believe the evidence The evidence was strong in the early years of the 20th century. It's even stronger today.
I got William Barrett's book on deathbed visions, which was published 100 years ago. And this talk about things that people report today is exactly the same experience. You would have thought that over 100 years, society would have caught up a bit.
Deathbed visions have been reported since the dawn of time. I mean, there's nothing new about them. I also mentioned something called terminal lucidity. That's the well-known, among medical professionals, the well-known phenomenon that in the final moments of life, terminally ill patients, including those who are suffering from any sort of injury to the brain, could be Alzheimer's, could be dementia, other forms of injury, physical injury, they suddenly regain complete lucidity in the final days, hours, or minutes before they pass. And I mentioned the case of one woman in my book. She was suffering from an extremely debilitating form of Alzheimer's. It had actually destroyed most of her hippocampus, you know, one of the more primitive structures of the brain. And she had been essentially a babbling lunatic for the past 10 years, couldn't recognize family members. But in the final hours before she passed over, she suddenly became lucid. She discussed family affairs with relatives and friends. And her daughter said it was like talking to somebody who had been asleep for 10 years. Now, this sort of, why do I talk about this? Well, because this is evidence from mainstream medicine that the mind and the brain are separate, that the relationship between the mind and the brain is really one of transmitter-receiver. I argue in my book that the brain does not produce consciousness, does not produce the mind. It works as a sort of receiver-transmitter for the mind, sometimes from body to mind as in sense perception, other times from mind to body as in willed action. And these experiences of terminal lucidity, nothing new. Hippocrates wrote about them, Cicero, Galen, others. And all these writers had took the view that in the final moments of life, what we see is the immaterial soul disengaging itself from the restrictions of a damaged material brain. Today, we have even more evidence. And it simply is not, it's a myth also. It's a myth that the British and American Societies for Psychical Research found nothing. They found a lot. It's an often repeated lie, but it is just that. And it's also a myth that mainstream psychiatrists, brain scientists, what have you, are skeptical about the existence of an afterlife. Many are not. Many are convinced by the evidence, including people such as Sir John Eccles. He won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his discovery how the brain transmits signals. It does something which he called chemicals, which he called neurotransmitters, which operate to exchange chemical signals in between the neurons of the brain. He was a dualist. He thought the mind and brain were separate, believed in an afterlife. There was also Wilder Penfield, the great Canadian brain scientist. He won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work with epileptic patients. He performed surgery on them. He says in his autobiography, he started off thinking that that the brain produces the mind, and he set out trying to explain it. And after all his research, he concluded exactly the opposite. He thought the relationship between the mind and the brain was that of programmer to computer. He thought that the mind programs the brain in order to perform certain tasks automatically, so we don't have to think about them. We've all had this experience, learning any new skill, driving a car, learning a new sport, playing a new musical instrument. At the beginning, it takes a lot of conscious effort. So what we're doing is we're programming our brains to handle the more routine tasks of playing the right notes or operating the controls of the car, what have you. But once we've mastered that, most of us can drive a car while we're daydreaming or having a conversation. In other words, we sort of give up. We operate on autopilot, so to speak. I'm not saying that's always a good thing, but we've probably all had the experience of, I don't know, say, driving to a friend's house on Friday night or on Saturday, what have you, and we suddenly find ourselves driving to work or driving to the grocery store. Why? Because our brain has is operating on automatic pilot. We've programmed it to do certain repetitive tasks, such as, for instance, drive to the grocery store.
What do you say to skeptics who might point out that the brain has been mapped and we know where memories are stored and we know where sight is? And if those parts are damaged, then people will lose their memories or their sight. So what's going on there in the interaction between, say, consciousness and the physical brain if consciousness is separate?
Well, if you damage a transmitter, a receiver or a transmitter, you're going to get distorted sound. I would use the analogy of smashing a radio's receiver and thereby concluding that the radio is producing the music. The radio doesn't produce the music. The radio transmits the music from another location. And it's the same thing with the damaged brain. And again, I mentioned the phenomenon of terminal lucidity, which the ancient writers and many modern writers believed indicates that in the final moments of life, the non-physical mind is disengaging itself from the restrictions of a damaged brain. Secondly, you raised two other issues there. You talked about how certain skills can be damaged by brain injury. Well, if you damage certain components of a television set, you may damage the sound, you may distort the sound, you may distort the image, the color, what have you, but that doesn't mean the television set's producing the signals. And secondly, when people have brain damage, their lost memories and lost skills frequently return after 6 months or a year. You also said that, third point, you said that we know where memories are located. Nothing could be further from the truth. They've done experiments with animals, unfortunate animals, octopuses, birds, and what have you. They'll teach them a new task. Then they'll systematically remove parts of their brain. Even with the majority of their brain removed, the animals still remember how to perform the task. This led one researcher to conclude that memory seems to be stored everywhere and nowhere, which isn't really saying anything at all. But you mentioned a lot of separate issues there. And I don't think that even the mainstream medical evidence, I don't think that it supports the idea that the mind ultimately depends upon a functioning brain. And of course, I mentioned a lot of other evidence to the contrary that's not from mainstream science in support of that view.
Yeah, because there's people with hydrocephalus who have a massive buildup of fluid in their skull and the brain gets kind of squished up. So it's just a little bit coating the interior of the skull. But you wouldn't know these people had this condition by talking to them.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the famous article, The Man Who Had No Brain. He was I believe he was a mathematics student. Quite a good one, too. And a scan of his brain showed that he had almost no brain tissue whatsoever. It's not the only case. I did mention terminal lucidity. I mentioned one case of a fellow named Surya. I believe he was somewhere in Asia, or he was at least from Asia. And he had it was either a brother or a cousin, I forget which, who was in a mental asylum. One day, the director of the asylum, this is about 100 years ago, called him and said, "Come quick, your brother wants to see you." And he was surprised by this. I mean, he wants to see me. He hasn't been talking for over a decade. And he found his brother perfectly lucid. Now, in those days, autopsies were much more commonly performed than they are today. Today, they're usually only performed upon the request of a family member or foul play is suspected. But in those days, as I said, they're much more commonly performed. They performed an autopsy on this mental patient after he died, and they found that his brain was almost entirely suppurated, meaning filled with pus. And this fellow named Surya asked himself, what in the world did this guy think with? I think that the evidence is overwhelming that the mind does not depend upon a functioning brain. And we don't even have to go into the so-called paranormal evidence. I don't like that word, but we don't have to go into the so-called paranormal evidence in order to establish that, in my opinion, is a fact.
And you talk in the book about where you may get into a discussion with a a skeptic or a debunker about all these kinds of things and how you would argue with them. One thing you talk about is confirmation bias. So could you just tell us what is that and how do we avoid it?
Well, confirmation bias refers to tending to seek out information that confirms what we already believe. So, you know, in the United States, and people have a certain right-wing bias, will tend to watch one news station, perhaps Fox News, and people who are more liberal-minded will tend to watch something else, such as CNN. I'm sure it's the same thing in the United States as well. So it's the tendency of most of us to seek out sources of information that confirm what we already know. I mentioned the quote of Richard Feynman, which got me thinking. He said, "You must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool." And this is what led me to explore or investigate contrary claims, because the only way to deal with this confirmation bias is to seek out contrary sources of information. Information from sources that disagree with whatever it is we happen to believe. And so I did this. I soon discovered a website devoted to debunking the idea of an afterlife. I was shocked. I was appalled by the author's vehemence, and the quotes he supplied from other so-called skeptics were equally unimpressive. He didn't really seem to know what he was talking about. He had an extremely distorted view. His philosophical ideas were, in my opinion, extremely simplistic. And so I wrote to this fellow stating my objections. He replied, and over the next few weeks, we engaged in an online debate. As a result, I gained great insight into the so-called skeptical way of thinking about these issues. And the result was my first book, Parapsychology and the Skeptics. It was a critical examination of the beliefs of the so-called beliefs and arguments of the so-called skeptics. My first publisher, unfortunately, went bankrupt. And so my second publisher renamed the book to Science and Psychic Phenomena, The Fall of the House of Skeptics. Rupert Sheldrake wrote the foreword to it. He really liked it. So then that led to my second book on the near-death experience, my third book on other forms of evidence, including mediumship and apparitions. And now my fourth book, The Case for the Afterlife, was released, about 2 months ago. Llewellyn, publisher in the States. It's a much shorter, more self-contained book. Instead of having the evidence spread out across three books, it's all in one place. It also introduces some new material and some new arguments. It's a much more focused book. I like to use the analogy that if my first three books were an armada, then this one is more of a surgical strike. But all my books should be considered as attacks on the so-called skeptical fortress.
So what about this other thing skeptics will say? It's anecdotal evidence, so therefore we can safely ignore it.
Well, the word anecdote comes from the Greek word anekdotos, meaning unpublished story. In other words, something akin to just, you know, what so-and-so told you. But as soon as it becomes published, then it's down in writing. You've got a name to it. It can be peer-reviewed. And it's no longer an anecdote. It's now a case study. And case studies certainly have their place. They're widely used in business schools. They're widely used in medical colleges. They have their case as long as they're documented and they're carefully studied. So we have to start somewhere. Rupert Sheldrake talks about this. It's simply unscientific to ignore any form of evidence, including anecdotal evidence, even if that anecdotal evidence serves to be nothing more than just a starting point for more in-depth investigation. It's a mistake to think that we need experimental laboratory evidence to conclusively establish things. Laboratory experiments have their place, but their place is to establish the relationship between two variables to see if there's a causal relationship, and if so, of what magnitude. but they certainly have their limitations. They have limitations that they tend to be unrealistic. They tend to, and the more controlled they are, the more they have what's called internal validity, the more we can be sure that the lab results are accurate. But there's a trade-off. The less external validity they have, because they're increasingly unrealistic and they're more difficult to apply to real-world situations. As I said, laboratory experiments have their place in order to establish the relationship and the magnitude relationship between two variables, such as, I don't know, an experimental new drug and survival rates for some particular disease. But we don't need experimental evidence or laboratory experiments to know that dinosaurs once walked the earth, that rocks sometimes fall from the sky, that the continents drift, or that Napoleon lost to Wellington at Waterloo. It's simply laboratory experiments have their place, but it's a limited place. And we shouldn't limit our investigations just for some methodological reason.
I wanted to talk about near-death experiences, and one of the cases in your book is Lloyd Rudy's patient, which is fascinating. Oh, yes. Was very well researched as well. Could you tell us what happened there?
They had a fellow in on Christmas Day. He collapsed. They were trying to bring him back, and they gave up, essentially. They declared him dead. And they didn't bother to turn off the various monitors that they had running. I guess they had other things to do. Rudy and his assistant were essentially standing in the operating theater talking about what else they could have done. After about 20 minutes, they heard a beeping from the machines and they wondered what's going on. Well, it turned out this fellow was spontaneously coming back to life. And they realized this, and they shouted, to the nurses to scrub up and the other assistants. They all went rushing in. They brought this fellow back to his side. A day or so later, Rudy interviewed him in the recovery room and asked the fellow what, if anything, he remembered, because they were all surprised that no one should come back to life after 20 minutes of having no heartbeat. And he remembered leaving his body. He remembered watching them, the efforts to resuscitate him. And most surprising at all, he remembered a series of post-it notes that had been left on a monitor for Dr. Rudy. Now, what they did was they would leave these post-it notes in a great big sort of long paper trail so that he would know which one came in first and which one came in last, so he could prioritize the messages. Rudy remarked that there's no way he should have known that, because you see, these post-it notes came in after he was unconscious. He was out after they were working on him and then trying to resuscitate him. But he did anyway. And his assistant, the assistant surgeon, agreed with him. He said the case is exactly as Dr. Rudy reported it. I was there. I can't explain it, but it happened.
And it was researched by Titus Rivas and Rudolf Smith, wasn't it? And they did further interviews.
Yeah, it first appeared on, I believe, YouTube, where Rudy was being interviewed by someone. And then they essentially followed up with their book, The Self Cannot Die.
Yeah, it's a great verification case, veridical. And there's so many of them around, isn't there? They're hard to argue against, I think.
I think so. And right now, the so-called skeptics of survival, I don't call them genuine skeptics. They're so-called skeptics. The pseudo-skeptics, the deniers, they've retreated into positions which are simply unfalsifiable. Now they'll say things like, well, maybe for all we know, there's some tiny little residual brain activity somewhere deep inside the brain that we simply cannot measure with our instruments. And maybe this is somehow generating conscious experience at a time when there's no blood flow to the patient's brain. Well, completely missing the point. Because no reputable physician or brain scientist believes that a brain that has been starved for oxygen and glucose because it hasn't had a blood supply is going to be generating conscious experience, even if there is some teensy-weensy little residual brain activity somewhere. So essentially, these people are grasping at straws, and that just is testimony to their desperation that they have to come up with such far-fetched, ridiculous pseudo-explanations.
Yeah, particularly if the near-death experiencer sees something in another part of the hospital or that may be miles away from the hospital.
Yeah, as you said, there's a number of radical near-death experiences in which accurate perception is reported.
So can we talk about mediumship and how much of that is, I don't know, you might say proven? Because there is that skeptical thing about, oh, the mediums are just fishing or they're fooling themselves. But real data does come through, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that mediums fish for information was one of the earliest explanations for the successes of mediumship. That's the idea that the medium somehow looks for conscious or unconscious clues coming from the sitter. A more exotic explanation, a proposed explanation, was that the results are due to some impressive degree of extrasensory perception occurring between medium and the sitter. Both these counter-explanations were refuted by the work of Reverend Charles Drayton Thomas. He was a Methodist clergyman and one of the earliest founding members of the British Society of Psychical Research. And he was challenged by a Professor Dodds to refute this view. And so Reverend Thomas came up with, he invented the procedure which became known as proxy sittings. And that's where a third party with no connection to the departed visits the medium on behalf of the person who's interested in departed. In other words, the person is a proxy sitter. The only information this proxy sitter is given is the name of the departed and their date of death. And so Reverend Thomas performed these experiments with a medium that he thought was reliable. And the successes continued unabated. There was no difference. And so the skeptical Professor Dodds was forced to concede that fraud, unconscious clues, and extrasensory perception between the medium and the sitter could not explain the data. So the hypothesis of living agent ESP was refuted. The so-called critics didn't stop there. They invented the unfalsifiable hypothesis of what I call super ESP. And that's the idea that mediums unconsciously employ vast, virtually unlimited powers of telepathy and clairvoyance to read the minds of individuals, regardless of what these individuals may be thinking of or where they might be, what they might be doing, or even if they're known to the medium, and also employ vast powers, virtually omniscient powers of clairvoyance to instantly scan books and other sources of written information in order to gain information about the deceased. And then they use their unconscious minds to present all of this as an elaborate deception, fooling not only the sitters, but also their own conscious minds. All of this is, of course, completely unfalsifiable. It's untestable. Actually, no, I take that back. It has been tested and it has been falsified. So to the extent that living agent ESP and its ideological cousin or descendant, super ESP, are testable, they've been proven false. To the extent that they're untestable, they're simply ideology. And the only reason they were proposed is for the sole purpose of opposing the inference of survival. I mentioned several cases in my book in which the results are exactly opposite from what living agent ESP or super ESP would predict. I also want to add that I mentioned several cases in which the personality of the departed comes through, even though the medium did not know the departed, and several cases in which the skills of the departed person are displayed, whether it's speaking a foreign language or playing chess or discussing philosophy. Now, there's no way that any form of perception, ordinary, extrasensory, super otherwise, can explain brilliant impersonations of people that we've never met, or explain the temporary and instant acquisition of skills which have never been normally acquired by the medium.
Have you ever wondered what happens after we die? In my new book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, I share 30 incredible stories of people who were clinically dead, some with no heartbeat, no brain activity, yet returned with knowledge that was later verified. These accounts challenge everything we think we know about consciousness and the afterlife. It's available now as an ebook, paperback, and audiobook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other good bookshops. Again, it's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife, and I hope you check it out. That's what I wanted to ask you about, because I've made a note here about how a deceased chess grandmaster was coming through, and he actually played a game of chess with a live grandmaster. And you'd think the medium would get destroyed pretty quickly, but they didn't.
Yeah, no, that was Dr. Eisenbeiss. He was an amateur chess player, and he asked one of his friends, Robert Rollins, an amateur medium, did not do it for money, to find a departed chess player who's willing to play a game with a living grandmaster. He found Giza Moroczy, who was ranked third in the world in 1900. He agreed to play. He also found a living chess grandmaster. Was it Korchnoi?
Yeah.
Victor Korchnoi. He was then ranked third in the world. This was in the early 1980s. And they arranged the play through Robert Rollins, who did not know how to play chess. He had an impeccable reputation for honesty. He was actually a musician by profession. As I said, he was an amateur. He did not perform mediumship for money. He had no financial stake. And they played, I think it was 50-something moves. Moroczy took him to 50-something moves before he conceded. I want to read something here because I had a quote.
Okay.
Yes. The physicist Russell Targ, he asked Bobby Fischer, who's considered to be one of the greatest chess players of all time, for his opinion of the case. He sent them this, you know, the scoring. And Targ writes, I sent the reported final chess score to Bobby Fischer, who, as I mentioned earlier, lived in Iceland, having been rescued from a Japanese jail by the kindness of the Icelandic government. Bobby wrote to me saying that, quote, anyone who can go 52 moves with Victor Korchnoi is playing at a grandmaster level.
Did they also say that the deceased player, when he was alive, had a reputation for having a really strong end game? And that's what came through in the mediumship as well.
Not only a strong end game, but also an old-fashioned opening game. Korchnoi began the game with a very old-fashioned opening, which is no longer taught. Korchnoi, the living grandmaster, remarked on this. He said his opening is very weak. It's very old-fashioned. But then he said he commented that the end game is really strong, and he was not sure that he was going to win. I mean, it was really that close. So if Robert Rollins, the medium, was somehow cooperating with the living grandmaster, it's highly unlikely the living grandmaster would use an old-fashioned opening, you know, that is no longer even taught.
And I wanted to ask about Friedrich Myers as well, who was communicating through different mediums, and eventually they worked out he was putting fragments with each medium, fragments of a message, and they had to bring them all together.
Yeah, you're talking about the cross correspondences. Those are pretty interesting. Some people consider those, the cross correspondences, to be one of, if not the single most convincing evidence for survival. Just want to find a case here. There's something that's actually quite astonishing.
Yeah.
I mentioned two different cross correspondences in quite great detail. One of them was what I call the Roden Noel case. Roden Noel was a poet, and various quotes from his poems or what have you came through in the scripts of two different mediums. But then here's one of my favorite messages of the cross correspondence. It says, I'm just reading from my book. It says, on March 14, before any of the above facts were known to Mrs. Holland, one of the mediums, non-professional, she wrote in a trance state, and here's the message, 18, 15, 4, 5, 14, 14, 15, 5, 12, not to be taken as they stand. See Revelations chapter 13, verse 18, but only the central eight words, not the whole passage. That was the message that came through. And this whole thing was meaningless to Mrs. Holland. She was actually a very esteemed woman. She was a justice of the peace. She was the first woman appointed by England to the League of Nations. So she was a very busy woman, and she wrote under a pseudonym. Her name was actually not Mrs. Holland's. It was Mrs. Coombe Tennant. Anyway, the whole thing was meaningless to her. And she did not look up the passage, but an employee of the British Society, Miss Johnson, did. And she found that the central eight words in that biblical passage from Revelations were, for it is the number of a man. So taking this as a hint, she translated the numbers given in the script into the letters of the alphabet, you know, with D being the fourth letter, E the fifth, and so on. And when finished, the letters spelled out Roden Noel, the departed poet.
So it was a code. The medium didn't know anything about it, and it pointed to him. And was it Myers, he put different fragments of his message to different mediums, and they had to bring the fragments all together to work out what he was saying.
Yeah, the cross correspondences, the individual messages themselves seem meaningless. Sometimes they seem almost like nonsense. Like, for example, when you just a list of numbers or a few lines of a poem or an anagram, you know, like, I don't know, like rats, star, tars, and so forth, or the equivalent words in Greek or Latin, such as aster, the Latin word for star. I'm referring to the famous Hope Star and Browning case, which also came through by Myers. I recently wrote an article, which should be published in the fall, on the famous Hope Star and Browning case. So yeah, the messages themselves they're fragmentary, they appear meaningless, but when put together, they were found to convey a coherent message or refer to a common topic. You have to also remember that the cross correspondences themselves appear to be very fragmentary and disjointed, but the other messages that come through when a cross correspondence is not being attempted, the other messages are very coherent and concise. There's long discussions on classical philosophy, discussions of personal matters, greetings to friends, all sorts of high level, coherent, consistent, discussions.
Do we move on to children with past life memories? Because that also can be very powerful. They just know stuff about a deceased person they couldn't possibly know. But one of the interesting things, I think, is the high incidence of violent death among the deceased people that the child believes they were.
Yeah, that's what Ian Stevenson found, high incidence of violent death. In other words, he concludes that it may very well be that these individuals feel cheated out of a full life and decide to come back or come back very quickly. Yeah. In these cases, Stevenson was an American psychologist or psychiatrist, I should say, and he was intrigued by these anecdotal reports that he heard about children in India who reported a previous life. And he decided to, he applied for a grant and he went to India and studied this. And he put two ads in different Indian newspapers, and he was astonished by the amount of, the number of replies that he got back. He wasn't interested in the sort of cases which he could not directly investigate. You know, 20 years ago, I remember my brother was saying that, no, he wanted cases which were still open. In other words, where the child was right now or at the time talking about a previous life. And he found several, which he investigated, and he was very impressed. Yeah, you mentioned they tend to be, there's a high incidence of violent death among the these children. They commonly report these memories as soon as they begin to talk. The memories start to fade by the time they're 7 or 8. By the time they're 9 or 10, the memories are almost completely gone. It's very rare for these memories to continue on into adulthood. But you also have to remember that these sort of cases are not just repeated or reported, I should say, in cultures which have religions that teach the doctrine of reincarnation. They're not just reported in the Far East and in Hindu and Buddhist cultures. They're reported by, these sort of experiences reported by, and their beliefs in reincarnation is found among North American native tribes, African tribes, the ancient Greeks. There's even evidence that the ancient Christians believed in, many of them believed in reincarnation until the Second Council of Constantinople, which was not called by the Pope. It was called by the Emperor Justinian. And it's believed that he had political motives in condemning the doctrine of reincarnation. But again, the early Christians seem to believe it. There are passages in the New Testament in which the disciples of Jesus ask him if a man who was born blind sinned in order that he was born blind, or his parents. And Jesus did not rebuke them in his reply. This indicates that the apostles, the disciples, I should say, had a belief in reincarnation. And even today, there's a Pew Center research, Pew spelled capital P, capital E, capital W. Pew Center research, they essentially do surveys of attitudes towards religion and what have you among people in the United States mostly. And they recently found that 29% of Christians in the United States accept reincarnation. So, and there's also many modern theologians and clergymen who are arguing for a reappraisal of reincarnation. Now, this sometimes bothers people because they think it's contrary to scripture. I argue in my book that it isn't. Many of these theologians and clergymen would agree to me. And it also bothers people because they don't like the idea of endless reincarnation, of being on the wheel forever. These fears are entirely groundless. As you pointed out, most of these children remember previous lives. They remember their previous lives ending violently, prematurely, and it seems that they may have felt cheated out of a full life. I also present evidence in my book that most of us only incarnate or come back 2 or 3 times. The fear of endless, being on endless cycle of birth and death and rebirth, in my opinion, is absolutely groundless. Nothing to be afraid of. I even quoted one theologian who argues for a reappraisal among Christians of the idea of reincarnation. He says, if I fail to learn the lessons of this life, should I not have to come back and repeat the lessons? But once the lessons are learned, there's simply no reason to repeat them.
And what do you make of this thing of children who have these past life memories will have birthmarks that seem to be in the same place where their previous life they were injured?
Stevenson talks about that. I don't go much into that. I go more into things like where Stevenson, he's taken some of these children who still claim to remember previous life to see the surviving relatives of the deceased personality, child claims to remember having been. And there are cases in which, you know, the surviving family members are understandably skeptical or suspicious, and they will try to trick the child, you know, with trick questions. You know, do you remember that time when this and this happened? And so I said, oh, no, that didn't happen. Or, yes, it did happen, but it wasn't so-and-so, like you said. It was, wasn't my my father. It was my brother who did that. Things like that. Many of these family members have been utterly convinced that the child is telling the truth. And also, the child's also, they fail to recognize people and places that have changed since the deceased personality left this world.
Because you've got the case of Bisheng Chand in your book.
Yeah.
And yeah. He remembers being in a family that was quite well off, but he was born into a family of poverty. And in the end, I think he thinks he may have been punished because he murdered somebody in his previous life.
Yeah, he was a heavy drinker and a gambler and quick-tempered and arrogant. He boasted about, as a child, he boasted about killing somebody in his previous life. We caught his girlfriend. Skeptics will sometimes say, well, you know, maybe he was just, maybe it was an elaborate fraud to try to extort money or somehow gain favor from the previous family. But that doesn't hold up because it was well known at the time that the previous personality's family had since become destitute. So it's not like there was any sort of financial motive. Bisheng Chand, when he was young, when he was a child, and he remembered his previous lives, remember his previous life as this arrogant young man, he slowly and gradually changed. He began to consider the possibility that his current poverty was a sort of cosmic or karmic retribution for the way he'd lived his previous life. And he changed and he grew up to be actually a kind and generous person of limited means.
You have all sorts of stuff about apparitions in your book.
Yeah.
One thing I noticed is maybe just a coincidence, like children who remember past lives where there was a violent end. There seems to be a characteristic of apparitions where their death seems to have been violent.
Yeah, I think that was our friend Frederick Myers who found that out. Yeah. And there are different types of apparitions, of course. There's, you know, the repeated hauntings, and there's crisis apparitions where they appear just once in order to perhaps issue a warning or say goodbye. Yeah, and I mentioned the case of the Cheltenham ghost. That's quite interesting. Extremely well documented. This figure seems to have been a woman, tall woman, dressed all in black. She was first reported by an 18-year-old female medical student, and she reported it using a pseudonym because she didn't want to jeopardize her medical career, which was unusual for the time, which I believe was the 1880s. And this apparition was reported by numerous people, sometimes at the same time, sometimes at different times, sometimes by more than one person at the same time. Myers thoroughly investigated the case, found absolutely no evidence of fraud, and there's no possibility, no real possibility of an ulterior motive on the part of the family. The father wanted to keep the case quiet because of the difficulty it led in attracting servants. The woman, the 18-year-old girl, did not want to jeopardize her medical career. As I said, she wrote about the case under an assumed name. So this is a case in which there was absolutely no, in my opinion, no rational possibility of fraud or mistaken eyewitness perception. Even dogs, cases of two different dogs who reacted to the figure. So animals don't react to fraud or human hallucination.
And it seems as though the apparitions are described as looking like normal people, because the classic idea is that they're transparent or you don't see their legs or something. But it's almost like you could pass one and you wouldn't know.
Yeah, no, they're normally taken to be solid living individuals. Many of the people who saw the Cheltenham ghost, visitors to the house, for instance, one of them remarked, who is that Sister of Mercy who's in the dining room? You know, she assumed she was a nun, I suppose, because she was all dressed in black. So, yes, they're commonly reported to be living, breathing human beings. And Myers, bring up our old friend again, he did a study. He found that in cases in which more than one person is present when an apparition is reported, at least two people will report seeing the apparition and from the proper perspective. In other words, one people may see the apparition from the front, the other from the back. It may be reflected in a mirror. It may or may not react to furniture in the room or people in the room. And usually it either gradually fades away or it simply suddenly vanishes or passes through a wall. And that's when the people realize that this was no living, breathing person.
Did you cover crisis apparitions at all?
A little bit. There's the case I call a father's warning. It was on Christmas Eve, and a young husband and wife had just put their baby to bed, and they'd gone to bed, and suddenly the wife noticed that a man in a naval uniform was standing at the foot of the bed. She saw him very clearly. She'd never seen him before, didn't recognize him, and she woke up her husband, and she said, look at this, look. Her husband was startled, and he shouted, "What are you doing here, sir?" It's reported that the apparition simply shouted twice, "Willie, Willie," before moving off to the side, blocking a lamp, passing through a wall. The husband leaped up, unlocked the bedroom door, and went through the house looking for an intruder. He came back, and his wife said, "Who was that?" And the husband was quite shaken and said, "That was my father. He's been gone 10 years. It turned out that the man at the time was planning to get involved in a scheme of financial fraud, which probably would have ruined him and his family. And it's thought that he took his father's visit as a warning not to enter into this this scheme, which he didn't. The husband, should be pointed out, this case was also thoroughly investigated by the British Society. The husband, it turned out, was a lifelong skeptic. He did not believe in apparitions of any sort, at least before. Other people testified that, yes, the husband and wife, their close friends, testified, yes, they did tell us this story. And, just another interesting case. That's an example of a so-called crisis apparition.
I heard one of a man that was in the trenches in the First World War at nighttime, and he was just sitting down. And his brother appeared from the other end of the trench, and he didn't know his brother was around. His brother saying, "Come, we have to go. We have to go. Let's go down the other end." So the two of them went down the other end of the trench, and then a German shell hit that point where the brother was sitting. And he turned around, and his brother was gone. And he found out later that his brother had been killed a few days beforehand.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't heard that case. There was another case from, I believe, was it the First or Second World War, where a platoon of soldiers stood for and sat for a photograph. And when the photograph was developed, they noticed in the back row there was somebody else, and that somebody else was one of their mates that had been killed in action a few days previously. So, yeah, there's plenty of stories like that from wartime, which is, I suppose, unsurprising in a way.
But it's been great talking to you. Thanks for coming on the podcast. The book's called The Case for the Afterlife, Evidence of Life After Death. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Well, Amazon, Goodreads, other outlets, and fine brick-and-mortar bookstores such as Barnes & Noble.
And could you go over your other books again quickly?
Okay. Well, the first book was originally titled Parapsychology and the Skeptics. It was renamed. It's currently named Science and Psychic Phenomena, The Fall of the House of Skeptics, This essentially deals with the so-called skeptical arguments against extrasensory perception, telepathy, clairvoyance, and the like. And it exposes the ideological nature of the so-called debate. The second book is Science and In-Depth Experience. I did not choose that title. I don't like it, but so be it. I always read the small print when you're signing a contract.
Yeah.
Science and Near-Death Experience, that deals, well, self-explanatory. The third book is Science and the Afterlife, that deals with other evidence for the afterlife, including mediumship. And as you said, the last book is The Case for the Afterlife, which argues on the basis of evidence only that the case for the afterlife has been proven beyond all reasonable doubt on the basis of 5 independent lines of evidence.
Fantastic. Thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Simon.
This week I was talking to Chris Carter about his book, The Case for the Afterlife, Evidence of an Afterlife. And if you want to hear the rest of this amazing interview, you can sign up to Patreon. When you sign up for $6 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $3 a month, you get an extended episode every month. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And you become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And there is an Our Paranormal Afterlife Facebook group. And if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.